Diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Hale, and hosting today with me is Brandon. This is being recorded on February 25th, 2024, but maybe you're listening way in the future. And currently, as it stands, and has been for the last number of months, there's very serious conflict going on in the Middle East, specifically in regards to Israel and Palestine. Mm-hmm. That's obviously a really hot-button issue, very legitimately so, and there's a lot of takes to be had there. This isn't really the show for that. That's not what we're going to be doing. But our listeners may know that you and I have discussed many times in the past media. We've taken up media topics, philosophy and media. Mm-hmm. And you and I have discussed quite a bit about how this sort of conflict is also playing out online.
Yeah.
And I want to say, just to be clear, not so much playing out online in terms of like stuff being posted, videos, imagery. Obviously, that stuff is there. Mm-hmm. But what you and I have found particularly interesting is the media discourse and the styles of media discourse that are going on. And yeah. In particular, not even mainstream media, because I think that's initially people pop in their head. You know, they think about, you know, interviews on CNN and, you know, the pop button topics at press conferences and all that. Television, you know, the big names, the presidents, the UN, the, you know, all the kind of stuff that's happening with that. Mm-hmm. But more, for lack of a better way of saying it, the comments section.
Yeah.
Of all this kind of stuff. The comments section on places like YouTube, the comments section on places like Reddit, on Twitter, on Instagram. These have become very hot, almost battlegrounds in and of themselves in the discourse around this conflict.
These are essentially the forums where these discussions are had, or in the little, you know, in the spaces between on the internet and social media, or even on the main platforms like Twitter and whatnot.
There are places where the very ground level, the very grassroots debates seem to be happening. Mm-hmm. But we thought we'd talk a little bit about this because, structurally speaking, from a sort of media theory perspective, it's quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's quite interesting to see the sort of rhetoric that's being used, the style. And I'm going to be honest, I'll elaborate more. It's also quite disheartening, considering all, you know, the suffering that's going on currently with this, you know, very real conflict, not to sort of conflate internet battles with, you know, literal. I don't comment that much on this kind of thing, but I do read some of this stuff. And what I really picked up on was something I would call the historical justification argument. Mm. I've seen it before. Obviously, it's pretty clear from the what I'm calling it, like people kind of think about what it is. I really have seen it like really, really take over in these current debates, these current discussions, this current conflict on both sides. Obviously, primarily people arguing for who are what you'd say pro-Israeli, you'd have people who are arguing who are pro-Palestinian. They both really, really utilize this historical justification argument, which basically looks it like really all that the argument, the rhetoric is recounting basically wide social or familial lineages to justify ownership or legitimacy in some place, or control over some sort of resource, whatever that might be.
Right.
That's pretty much it. And, you know, I see all the time, I see people who are very clearly pro-Palestinian will immediately jump in comment sections and start giving, like, you know, sometimes paragraphs, answers on basically the history of their perspective on, really, the history of Palestinian people in Palestine.
Right.
And then the next comment down, the response will literally be the opposing version of that, but for Jewish people, for Israelis in the area, however you want to phrase it. Mm-hmm. Same sort of thing. How their families, how Jews have been in the area for thousands of years, all the sort of the history behind it. And I find it very interesting. It's an interesting kind of rhetoric because, one, it's being used very much against itself. It's not really a convincing form of argument in terms of persuading the opposition, especially when the opposition is using literally the same style of argument.
There's something interesting about, because this, if it's two people's coming to a head about legitimacy, one of the things you could do is to take a form of argument that isn't in the same tact, as it were. If someone says, well, I've been here for this long, you could just assert, I've been here this long as well. But that is essentially to give into a conflict. You're not really, if argument is a way of avoiding some kind of, a physical altercation, if it's a way of trying to discuss things, this seems to be combat in words. It's the assertion.
I would describe it as being disheartening because it very clearly perpetuates the conflict further. I want to say as well, like, although we're talking about this within the relationship of the current Israel-Palestine conflict, this is very much a rhetorical device that is used almost universally, particularly within political and international conflicts and that kind of thing. But also within internal social disputes too. You know, claims around like how long certain people's families have been in a certain area versus other people's families is very regularly, or social groups or whoever it might be, they might not even be blood relatives really, has really permeated a lot of our political discourse these days. You see a lot of that kind of stuff. But I think the problem is, or the immediate issue that I see with it is kind of what we're saying, is it's not convincing. If you and I are sharing a home, if we've been living in the same space, we've been living in the same house, and we both want each other out and we're both committed to our story, well, me like telling you the story of how I got here and how long I've been here and why I deserve the whole space or whatever it might be, or certain areas that I think shouldn't be shared or whatever it's going to be. That's not really like a way to resolve conflict. Right. It's really just a way to illustrate impasse. Right.
Yeah.
Like it's effectively people repeating the same reasons for why, you know, these abhorrent things are happening over and over and over again. And I think it's very disheartening as a relatively external observer to see, because in the hope that, like, you know, violence will stop, that peace will happen, when both two political sides, really emphasizing the political entities with these and not necessarily the wider population, the political sides, when people are so vehemently committed to this historical narrative, and not just that it's true as like facts, this is a really important point, not true, not just that, you know, the facts are like, these are the facts, you know, people have been here since this long and they're this and this and this, and, you know, through the ages, but that it is a justification for negating someone else's claim effectively. And then the opposition is doing the exact same structure to you.
Yeah.
All it's doing is perpetuating conflict.
Yeah.
And I find it very, like, getting back to the online discussion component.
Yeah.
Maybe you can comment a bit about this, that it seems very, like, people, it almost seems like people don't realize that that's, like, they're really just perpetuating the same sort of narratives that have led to so much violence in the past and continue to do so.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, it's interesting too, because we can think about people having these, let's call them irreconcilable, sort of rhetorical battles, as it were. That might be one form of doing combat, let's be perfectly honest. They might actually understand that we are engaged in a conflict, and what we have to do in a conflict is assert ourselves. That's how you win a conflict. You assert yourself in some form, and one form of that might be rhetorical. That's a legitimate move that you have to make if you're engaged in a combat. I think the interesting discrepancy that we're going to be kind of picking at, though, is that it's kind of happening over a ostensibly non-combative space like social media, where the picture that we have of social media is that it's this place where, you know, that's that we can put that stuff aside and we can have these discussions, and discussion always curtails a kind of violence, because discussion isn't people violating each other physically or even in this rhetorical way. It's people supposed to, they're supposed to come to the table and listen to each other and consider things. They're not just supposed to be doing this. So I think the discrepancy that you're pointing to is that it's interesting to see that it is in fact happening, and specifically talking about the way that media is structured, it is interesting that the social media platforms that we have make possible these forms of rhetorical combat. And you were mentioning too that, especially because I'm thinking that certain social media platforms, so if we're thinking about some of the, you know, prime principles of media theory, that the medium is the message, then some of these platforms are going to make certain kinds of communication possible, difficult, impossible. When I compare something like Reddit to Twitter, those are two radically different forms of communication. On Reddit, I imagine people posting many, many paragraphs and then replying with an amount, you know, an enormous amount of consideration. People are, whether they're being cordial or not, they have the space to communicate thoughts that need a certain amount of space. Whereas on Twitter, much of the communication that is being done is what we tend to think of as media, right? So photographs and videos, and also sharing quick links and sharing other people's thoughts, or directing people to kind of resources or something like that. But it's a lot more fast paced. So I guess just bringing, because I think you're right to want to keep this at the level of the media theory, right? That's what we're mostly interested in.
I think you've brought up really two interesting things though within the context of media, that I'm really glad you brought them up. I want to just take like a step back, because I want to address the one that you brought up first. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, earlier I said it's really disheartening, because, you know, I see the historical justification Reddit rhetoric used. And I should say that ostensibly, most of the time people are talking about, like, they want peace, they want the violence to stop, all this kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And then the historical justification arguments come out, and then they just come out at each other. And I'm sitting there being like, well, you know, of course people are continuing to fight and all this terrible stuff is happening, because yeah, we're not going to get anywhere with this. You brought up, though, something really interesting that I did not think about before. And it's perhaps even more disheartening than I was thinking earlier, which is, you basically said, let's be frank, it's a continuation of the battle. And, you know, now that I really think about it, I think for listeners and stuff that Brennan might be right. Unfortunately, I think a lot of times what we see, whether it be Reddit, Twitter, and we're going to talk more about those because it's really interesting in the context of like hard media theory. But what you are seeing is less people genuinely arguing for a place of coming to resolution, and more actually holding the line on their factional perspective.
Right.
Right. And so I think that even went over my head a little bit reading this sometimes, where it's like, you know, these people say they want peace. I guess a lot of times I assume people want the violence to stop, but perhaps as much as it's hard to say, that is not, oftentimes isn't actually the case. What's really going on is you're seeing in real time this very real physical conflict playing out online.
Yeah.
And seeing those battle lines being drawn, and seeing those, and those arguments, like you said, like ostensibly places like social media are supposed to be open places of peaceful discussion, but that's not actually what's happening. Like, people are using arguments effectively for a kind of online violence. And that's very concerning. But it's not, the more I think about it, you know, we're living in an age of more and more conflict.
Yeah.
There is just considerably more serious military conflicts going on. It's very concerning. I think we're planning on talking about it a little bit later on.
Mm-hmm.
But this sort of rhetorical battling that's going on, it's unsurprising that it's the case, because we're also seeing these, well, that may in fact, let's take it for granted that that stuff is more grassroots.
Yeah.
There's certainly a lot of powers at play directly trying to influence online discussions.
Right.
And be directly involved in that kind of stuff, and creating basically new propaganda. I don't mean new propaganda in terms of like individual new pieces of media yeah. propaganda, but I mean new propaganda is in like a new style of propaganda mm-hmm. that intercedes on online discussions, that intercedes on news articles, that intercedes on forums, and like presents itself as being like a legitimate actor.
Yeah.
When it's really not. And we see that happen a lot. And that's not with this current discussion. That's not what I'm saying is happening all the time. But it's, the more I think about it, the more it's like, if you certainly have some of that, you have people directly coming into influence, and you have lots of people who are very legitimately, or just genuinely at the very least, extremely upset about what's going on and taking a side. Well, that really coalesces into effectively online battle groups.
Mm-hmm.
As much as they might present as people trying to have discussions, that's not really what's going on.
Yeah.
It's more like a loose knit, basically like front for whatever sort of political, like political position you're taking.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting.
And then I think, go ahead.
I was going to say, just on that point, I mean, I think it's interesting because I know on Twitter that, there was going around pieces of essentially propaganda that Israel was putting out. And the novel kind of thing about this is that it's from, like, you know, at Israel as a user of this platform. And it's, I think it takes a similar form, but just on a much grander scale that I see with things like, you know, the Wendy's Twitter account, where they will kind of interact with people on
funny and relatable website.
Yeah, it's funny and relatable. So there was a piece that was put out by Israel. It was kind of like a mocking particular, I guess. Well, I mean, it's mocking opposition to them. That's what you should be doing if you have particular interests in a information war. But it was just interesting to, I don't know, I guess it was just interesting to see that that was, it took the same space on the screen as any other user's kind of, you know, tweets, essentially. The form of social media is conducive of conversations. It's conducive of these rhetorical fronts that we're having. It's conducive of a, you know, just a putting out essentially propaganda as well.
And let's, like, even stepping away from Israel-Palestine for a second, it's been really interesting for me, like for both of us, I think, we probably both agree with this. You know, you and I grew up with the internet. We're both millennials. We're about the same age. You know, I remember first getting online as a kid, you know, having dial-up, probably like 9 years old, my mom's like first real computer at home or whatever it's going to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's been interesting to see, like, especially in the last few years, the intensity of propaganda online. And it's really, it's gone from like very obvious, like it's basically just like an ad, right, for some political movement, to literally making content that replicates, like, you know, content made for the sake of itself, for lack of a better way of saying it, when it's really content made for the sake of some political end, right?
Yeah.
That we can think about that as being a simple definition of propaganda within the context of the online sphere, you know, influencing people for a political end, but presenting itself as like independent content.
Yeah.
Like even stepping away from our current context, a couple of things that I've seen, I'm on YouTube quite a bit. That's one of my main sort of places for, you know, video content. I've seen two really obvious examples of propaganda that have like started to show up in my feed, get recommended to me a lot. One is, so travel vlog, I should say travel vloggers are very popular online. It's a big thing,
yeah,
obviously. And I started seeing these travel vlogs from China being recommended to me by, from a local Chinese person. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say I'm 100% sure this is propaganda, but I'm going to sit here and say I'm 98% sure it's propaganda.
Right.
Because it was still a little clunky, and I noticed in the videos that there was never anything. It was very, very pro-China on a ground level. Very, like, pro-Chinese people, very pro, like, presenting China as, like, it's just like anywhere else, and it's so beautiful and lovely, and the government is awesome. Anyways, it was this younger girl, probably around our age, Chinese, who was going around within China and basically vlogging about it. And I really got the sense that what this was basically government-sponsored vlogging, right? To try and make China, like the, you know, trying to basically drum up a perspective of China that is like as positive as possible.
Yeah.
But doing so in a way that's very everyday.
Right.
Not super shiny, not super glamorous. It's just like some very kind of like average girl going around about meeting everything. But everything just had a very positive spin about it.
Right.
Like everything was good. There was never anything bad to say. Everything was very like promising. It was always kind of pointing out to like, oh, and the local state government is doing this, and look at this like new dam they're building, and we've got, oh, they, oh, I'm in this town now, and they've got like a very advanced like XYZ. And,
right.
You know, it was kind of always pointing out these sorts of things. So that was one thing where I was like, and it was low-key really reminded me almost of like that kind of Soviet style of propaganda where it was like, look at how much closer we are to like the bright new future. Everything's so positive here. Then I see American propaganda, which is hilarious, online. And I get recommended these girls from these this very, like, attractive e-girl-looking, like YouTuber.
Yeah.
Who is apparently in the U.S. Army.
Right.
And is a tank driver and puts out these little, like, super quick snippet vlogs being like, what's it like for me being, like, a tanker in the U.S. military? Like, full makeup, super attractive. That very kind of, in particular, very popular now, especially for people online, sort of female look, which, as I already described, is the kind of e-girl sort of vibe.
Yeah.
With that, especially with that sort of red blush in the cheeks and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so watching her basically do all these shorts where it's like shooting machine guns, driving around in a tank, isn't the U.S. Army sick? Right? Like... It, like that kind, like just literally that kind of stuff. Very blatant, very intense, very sexual. And I was like, you see these two very different styles of propaganda, but both coming at them in terms of like trying to seem also grassroots, like trying to seem like is, you know, thinking we're talking about propaganda here and media. You know, it was Joseph Goebbels who was the head of the propaganda arm of the Nazi Party, the Third Reich State. It's very openly said that the best propaganda is propaganda that people don't know is propaganda, that people think is just entertaining media.
Right.
Right?
Huh.
We don't want people thinking that they're watching propaganda. We want people to feel entertained. We want people to feel excited. We want people to feel like they care about what they're watching and not like they're actually watching a piece of propaganda.
Right.
And coming back to this like wider discussion, we're seeing this sort of stuff interceding in all sorts of online media spaces in a way that's very, I would say, like, propaganda is always duplicitous, but there's, like, an extra layer of duplicity going on.
Yeah. I was going to say, too, about... because what you're talking about here is that these forms of propaganda should not take the form of propaganda. But if that's what the form of propaganda is going to take, then propaganda has no set form anymore. The form of propaganda now, as you're kind of saying, is malleable. It can take the form of certain kinds of posts, or it can take, you know, a video form or a genre format or a meme format or something like that. I mean, that's kind of what we've been noticing throughout all of this, is that, and I think that goes to a little bit of the, I don't want to say paranoia, because I think it's a bit justified if this is true, that propaganda doesn't have a set form anymore in terms of, you know, whatever we could try to remember propaganda used to be. If it explains a bit of the anxieties that people have about using social media in general, I think. People who are more or less, people who are using social media intelligently, I think, are using social media skeptically. They are encountering what they encounter in the mode that you are encountering it, saying, okay, well, something doesn't seem right here in this instance, right? I'm watching a YouTube video, but it's not like the other YouTube videos that I've watched. You know, you probably watch a lot of travel YouTube videos because you yourself have done a bit of traveling and have an interest in it. So to see something kind of not jive with what you're used to seeing as you go through this kind of content, that might itself kind of be the form that content takes. The other thing that I wanted to say too was, you were talking about how this stuff isn't, it is grassroots in a certain way. You know, it might actually just be users who really love the U.S. Army going out and making these videos. It probably isn't, but that it takes that form, right? It's no longer just, okay, well, it's not on the news, so it can't be propaganda. It's not on the TV, it's not on posters, it can't be propaganda, right? It takes different forms. It's no longer, to say that it's grassroots is to say that it has kind of found its way into the media that we would call user-generated content, right? You can't discern whether this, well, you can kind of discern because you have this feeling of it, but that it's wedded into a network of everyone else's YouTube shorts or tweets or something like that, it gives it a sense of distance from, I guess, what we would call mainstream news media or mainstream media or something like that. I mean, I don't know if people who would say things like, well, you know, you probably, and I've seen in many YouTube comments, people saying things like, well, you're not going to see this on the, you know, in the mainstream news media. Well, to be
in the lamestream media.
Yeah. To be perfectly clear, if you're seeing it on social media, you are seeing it in a permitted realm. But
yeah. I think I got you really reminded me of something. But before I say it, I just want to let listeners know that you listen to the Canadian Philosophy Show. And today we're discussing basically our current observations on online propaganda and sort of political, I should say, online discourse, online propaganda, and sort of, we'll think we'll discuss a little bit more about the sort of current political movements and trends a little bit. But one thing that you said that I think was really interesting, and it's actually great to clarify, is you brought up the point of propaganda and user-generated content. Now, when I was talking earlier about, say, the Chinese vlogger girl or the U.S. Army girl, it's entirely possible that those aren't officially sponsored content streams, right? It's entirely possible that, like, let's take the U.S. Army girl for a second, that, like, she is just, like, doing that for fun. That doesn't not make it propaganda, though.
Yeah, that is true.
And I think especially, that's especially true today, is if there's, if, as long as this person has a particular ideological bent or interest that they're trying to promote, then it's a kind of propaganda. And that's what's become so complex is, you know, back in the day, you know, we think of, we still have this tendency to think about propaganda in this very kind of like 1984-esque kind of way.
Yeah.
Where there's a super central state, you know, there's Big Brother, there's, you know, the Nazi Party, there's this, the, you know, the Communist Party, the Soviet